Growing Up Somali in Maine, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're a Somali immigrant in Lewiston, Maine, and the mayor says to you,
just don't try to insert your culture, which obviously isn't working, into ours, which does.
But one young Somali woman in Lewiston is trying to bridge the cultural gap, and her success is a point of family pride.
Basically, I'm holding a very, powerful seat in the house right now.
Her story's ahead, plus a crowded refugee camp doesn't offer much privacy.
When I go there, I started questioning, how did people make sex? How did they sleep together?
And that led to some intimate portraits of refugee bedrooms. The stories plus the film set in Turkey vying for an Oscar ahead on The World. Glad you could make it here. We kick off in Europe today, Denmark specifically. It's one of the countries struggling to cope with the arrival of large numbers of refugees, and there are signs the welcome is not what it used to be. Today, the Danish parliament approved a new law that allows the government to seize the assets of asylum seekers, as in any cash or valuables that they have, in excess of $1,500 when they enter Denmark. The UN says that may violate international rules on refugees, and many in Denmark are appalled by the idea. Jesper Tobo Carlsen is the political editor for Politiken newspaper in Copenhagen.
It's very much a divider in Denmark. Polls suggest that about half the population in Denmark supports this, and the other half is either sort of indifferent or very much against it. So it's definitely a divider.
So where would you say we're at in terms of frustration among Danes with the arrival of these new migrants, especially since last summer when we saw a really kind of welcoming attitude among a lot of Europeans toward the migrants? Where are we at today?
The atmosphere has definitely changed over the last 6 months. In Denmark, you could definitely detect a very open atmosphere in September, October, when there was a sudden rise in the number of asylum seekers. And you can see from polls that most Danes supported that we should not only accept asylum seekers, but we should also cooperate in Europe between the European countries about how we divide them between us. This atmosphere has changed, and the atmosphere is somewhat harsher now, and the political rhetoric is much harsher.
Your kind of notion that the policy brings migrants into line with Danes who are out of work and they have to sell assets above a certain level to claim unemployment benefits, so why not the migrants? I mean, if the government is rationalizing it that way, I'm wondering if there's a risk of aggravating the anger that unemployed Danes have with the migrants, whom they see as potentially taking jobs they might otherwise get.
Yeah, that is an issue, and that is definitely also an issue when we discuss, as we do now also in Denmark, how all these new immigrants should and asylum seekers should be a part of the labor force in Denmark. There's a debate in Denmark, as in other European countries, should they be allowed to work for lesser pay, or should employers be allowed to hire them for less money, which would probably be a good thing for bringing people into the workforce, but it could aggravate the latent anger in the working population if jobs were offered for less wage. So that is an issue.
Yeah, and also, once the assets are seized of asylum seekers, aren't they in kind of even more limbo?
That is a big concern that has been raised. It has been ignored by the government, but you could certainly make the argument that as a tool of integration, this is counterproductive, because if you are stripped and have basically nothing, you're further away from being a citizen and taking part in Danish society.
So, Jesper, what do you think? Will this new legislation actually dissuade migrants from entering Denmark?
I think when migrants make a decision about fleeing their country, where to go, it's a factor of many things. And the atmosphere in one country or another probably plays a role, but I think a minor role.
Jesper Tobo Carlsen, the political editor for the Politiken newspaper in Copenhagen. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Northern France is another place that's attracted a large number of migrants and refugees. Many are living there now in large camps, often in terrible conditions. One of those camps is near the city of Dunkirk. Migrants there stay in tents that rise up from the mud. And now that it's winter, it's hard to stay warm. But some of the migrants have found a haven at a cafe just across from the main train station. Our own Adeline Sear paid a visit.
From the outside, the tiny cafe El Bod doesn't look like anything out of the ordinary. But step inside and you're part of an unusual scene in Dunkirk. About 24 young Kurdish men sit comfortably at the cafe's tables, sipping warm drinks. Here, barely any French is spoken. Folks mix a little English with Kurdish words.
It means, hello, sir. How are you? What will you drink? Give me the money.
Laura Six is the owner and bartender here. She's 24. She opened her cafe in 2013, but business only began to pick up about 3 months ago when waves of Kurdish refugees settled at the nearby migrant camp in Grand Sainte. With her new clientele, Laura Six had to learn some Kurdish.
Ça veut dire si tu bois pas, tu pars.
Nahum brodere kaka. That means if you're not going to drink, man, get out of here.
Six says she's selling a lot more tea these days. Most of her new customers are Muslims who don't drink alcohol.
Oui, ben il y a beaucoup de migrants, donc beaucoup plus de thé.
Yes, well, there are a lot of migrants here, so that means a lot more hot tea.
The young men here seem completely at ease. They spend hours in what's become their daytime home. For people who live in small tents in a muddy camp, the cafe is one of the few places where they can find warmth and camaraderie. Six describes her new customers.
Ah, c'est des jeunes de 20 à 50, 60 ans aussi.
It's a lot of youth, but men from 20 to 50 or 60 years of age as well. A lot of young guys today, though. Women are rare. They tend to stay at the camp. Guys come in, they drink their tea, and they charge their cell phones.
They also play pool and football, and sometimes Six even plays with them. It's clear Laura Six cares about these men. When all the electrical outlets are occupied with charging cell phones, she takes out large power strips from behind the bar. Cell phones are the migrants' lifeline to friends and family around the world. Laura Six's good customer service is sincere, but these young men are helping her out too. She says the cafe was barely surviving before they arrived, so those young Kurds ordering tea all day long may have helped her keep her business going. But do her new customers keep the locals away?
Bah, ils venaient déjà pas auparavant.
Customers were already scarce before them. Some stopped coming, some died, some didn't come at all. But the Kurds are very nice to me, much nicer than the French. They are kinder, and they treat me like their sister. It's great, because they are a bit like my bodyguards.
Sure, but this young blonde bartender is no pushover. She knows how to handle her male customers when they get out of line.
Ayoub!
She calls to one of the guys dancing around with the pool cue.
Je vais te défoncer.
I'm gonna kick you hard.
Reste tranquille.
Ah, crazy.
She says she's grateful for her new Kurdish customers, but their presence also brings the police around a lot more. And not everyone in the town appreciates the migrants here. For example, the lack of showers at the camp became an issue in the town last month.
Ben, ils sont dans la boue du matin au soir. Ils ont pas de quoi se laver.
They're in the mud all day. The showers are dirty or don't function well at the camp, so it's impossible to wash. That's why they all go to the public swimming pools to shower.
And that upset some Dunkirk residents. Someone even started rumors that the migrants were spreading disease. Alone behind the bar, Laura Six shrugs off the rumors and fears.
The thing is, in here, we don't look at them as migrants. We look at them as normal people. But many people do discriminate and turn them away. The migrants come where they feel welcome. And at least when they are here, it's clear what they are doing. If they are at my place, they're not on the streets.
For the world, Adeline Sear, Dunkirk.
In Southern California, three escaped prison inmates are still on the run. They're the ones who sawed through steel bars to break out of a maximum security jail last week. Police have appealed to the Vietnamese community in L.A.'s Little Saigon for help finding them. All three escapees were awaiting trial for violent crimes and are considered dangerous. L.A. Times reporter Ann Doe has been out talking with people in Little Saigon. She says the community is abuzz with news of the prison escape.
Well, two of the three men are Vietnamese, and their names, as well as their faces, have been splashed on all the Vietnamese language newspapers. People are saying if they really want to fit in and that's their motive, this is the perfect place to hide out. Some folks are worried that if the fugitives are desperate and need quick money, they could, you know, just jump out and hold people hostage. But there's also talk that they could be on their way to Bangkok using Thailand as a gateway into Vietnam.
Is anybody, did you speak with anybody in Little Saigon who's nervous, who actually is afraid that these escapees may be hiding in their community?
On the outskirts of Little Saigon, Marco, we went to an apartment complex where one of the convicts' family members are living. And a lot of the residents there had heard about this escape, and they were very worried. They're on alert and warning each other.
So tell me just a little bit more about Little Saigon in L.A. How long has it been around since, like, the Vietnam War, and how insular is it today?
There are people who can live there and exist day to day without having to speak English. There's every manner of service available, just like there is in the mainstream. And the community sprung up in the late 70s, a few years after the end of the Vietnam War in 1975. It's very active, it's very political, and it's somewhere where there's always things happening. But this escape situation, this has never come to Little Saigon before. So people are very worried, number one, about their reputation to the outside world, and number two, about their personal safety. They're saying that if someone among us recognizes one of these guys, should we call the police? Number two, if we just stay out of this, you know, we can move on with our lives. But the flip side is, hey, they're still around. So should we jump in and work with the authorities, or should we turn away from it?
What are the police saying at this point? Is the search picking up speed?
The police is putting the pressure on because this is the fourth day of the search, and they have appealed in Vietnamese and in English for help. They consider one of the three fugitives, the youngest guy who's 20, a documented Vietnamese gang member, and they strongly believe that these guys are likely embedded somewhere in the community. They do not think they have fled the state or the country.
So what's the mood right now in Little Saigon, kind of developing a fortress mentality?
It's very edgy. People are looking over their shoulders, but the very few that haven't heard about this story or this saga, they're getting poked and saying, hey, where have you been? Check it out and read up on it.
Ann Doe with the Los Angeles Times, thank you very much for telling us about this.
Okay.
Still to come on The World, she comes from Tuva, north of Mongolia. She practices the ancient art of throat singing, but her first musical influence was Ima Sumac from Peru.
And then I discovered, of course, Ella Fitzgerald and Miriam Makeba and then Billie Holiday. And then later on, of course, Tina Turner, singers like this, you know, or Amy Winehouse.
Peruvian jungle vocalizing plus Amy Winehouse equals throat music. Naturally, that's later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. I got to see a movie the other day that was a joy to watch. There were no chase scenes, no shoot-em-ups. It was not tightly edited and didn't give you vertigo between rapid-fire dialogue. There was a real story, and it immersed you in someone else's life that is not your own. The film is Mustang and has been nominated for a Best Foreign Language Oscar from France. It's set in rural Turkey, and it's about five sisters, orphaned, who live with their uncle and grandmother. Mustang refers to the demeanor of these young women in the 21st century, struggling to be modern but confined to tradition by their elders. And once the elders realize how modern their girls want to be, they proceed to marry them off one by one. Mustang was written and directed by Denise Gamze Argoven, who grew up between France and Turkey.
Turkey is a society which is quite paradoxical, and you have people living extremely modern lives, and women voted their earlier than in many other countries, as early as in 1925. But the society is also extremely patriarchal and mainly very conservative. Today, the politics of the country are worrying me more than a little bit, and the problems of Turkey go way beyond just the questions of gender. But it's true that one of the big debates or even arm wrestle which is taking place in Turkey is about a choice of societies, and it's very much articulated over the place of woman. The question of woman is extremely central.
I can't move on without asking you, why are the politics worrying to you right now?
Oh my God, it's just...
Briefly.
Right now, like, Turkey has become the country where you have the most journalists in prison. Anybody criticizing the actual president is prosecuted. Yeah, it's not a good place to be.
So let's talk about the women in Turkey who are represented by these sisters in your movie. It's not set in Istanbul, mm-hmm. where you'd expect the most modern face of Turkey today. It's set in a village near the Black Sea. Why are these girls, why do they seem so sophisticated? Are they just representative of all girls' hopes in Turkey today?
There's a specific age, exactly as the characters of the film, just before you're a teenager, where all of a sudden there's nothing that you do which is perceived as innocent anymore. Like you're told to watch your body all the time. And there's like really something which is very striking to me specifically in Turkey, among the countries I know well, which is a filter of sexualization through which women are seen. And anything that they do, from the moment you give it a sexual charge, it allows people to just restrict women to a very specific point in society. In the opening scene, when the girls sit on the shoulders of the boys and they're accused of having rubbed themselves against the necks of the boys.
Yeah, they're kind of playing, doing one of those, what we call chicken fights in the swimming pool.
That's a scene that I lived. One of the many, many, many anecdotes that I had, which said the same thing, which said that we've reached a turning point, and from one specific moment on, it's finished. Like, you as a girl are perceived as sexual.
You grew up in Turkey?
I grew up between France and Turkey. I'm French-Turkish. All my family history is Turkish. And I think it's also because I've been going back and forth that I zoomed in and out of the experience of being a woman in Turkey, that it made me articulate something which would have been maybe too familiar to point if I had spent all my life there.
I don't want to give away the end of the film, but Lale does have this very close relationship with her school teacher, whom we meet very briefly. And she does seem to symbolize this teacher, kind of the progressive voice of women in Turkey. How polarized is this world of liberated and non-liberated women?
At this point, Turkey is polarized as it could ever be. Really, like the country is divided as possible. And the one thing among women is that women don't necessarily articulate in a very conscious way aspirations for freedom. And sometimes, you know, there are women who reproduce patriarchy. For example, in France, it's surprising how often you would hear women say, "I'm not a feminist," and almost being ashamed of being a feminist. Mm. And for me, it's very surprising. It's just maybe a way of not questioning a society you're so familiar with and you've lived in your whole life. I don't know.
Well, the sisters paint feminist on the road in very large block letters, so I think we know where they stand. I'm curious, did you ever see this kind of tradition and oppression of women in your own family, like among cousins or aunts?
Forced marriages, no, but I know a lot of people. For example, in my life, yes, there are women just a little older than me who have been married exactly like the girls. Then figures of people running off to Istanbul as well. My ex-father-in-law, for his first wedding, he was very much in love with a girl, and their parents, the parents of the girls, refused the marriage. So he just, with her consent, kidnapped her, and they flew and they got married in Istanbul. And again, when I used to live in Ankara for a few years when I was a kid, there was a young girl who plotted her escape to Istanbul to marry her true love during a whole year. And I was her confidant, and it was, you know, she was telling me the whole escape plan.
Did she escape?
Yeah, she did. She did.
She did.
Uh-huh, she did.
I mean, which leads me to believe that what we see with these sisters in this village, I mean, they're not just constrained. They are literally confined to their family's home with bars on the windows and locks on the gates. Do you find that? Does that happen?
That's really very much fiction. But when you went a little bit inland inside small villages, yes, there was households where you had the mother of the household, and she had maybe a daughter who was not married yet, and she had a son, and the son would have his wife who lived in the same house, and she would be almost like a servant in that house. That's something which was quite common, like girls being married off and arriving in a family where they are a bit lower member of the family. That's something I've seen a lot. But then there are things like the scene of Selma, who is taken to the hospital in the middle of the night because she hasn't bled.
Right.
It's a scene a doctor told me as being an occurrence. It's not like something crazy he came across just once. So you see cohorts of people coming out of a wedding after having danced for hours. They have this bride in her wedding dress, and they bring her to the doctor to see if she's a virgin or not. That's something like that. The doctor who told me the story said he sees it at a season of wedding 40 to 50 times a year. But at the same time, you have in Istanbul people who are just like freer than free and more modern than modern, and both extremes.
Denise, you are French and Turkish. Mustang is a French production and is France's submission to the Academy Awards. How has the film been received in Turkey?
Well, in Turkey, initially, it was, just as the country, extremely polarized. There was nothing in the middle, either very, very passionate reactions, positive reactions, or extremely negative reactions. And now that the film has gained momentum abroad, the debate is even more muscular, and people fight about the film on social media and all the time, and the fight is becoming bigger and bigger. And the other day there was this woman who wrote something like, I was so sick of seeing these girls are wriggling in front of the camera. And a man just answered to her like, if you just looked at them as children, you wouldn't write something like that. And the film sometimes doesn't open the train of thoughts you would hope it would, but maybe with time.
Denise Gamze Argüven is the director of Mustang. The film's been nominated for an Oscar in the foreign language film category. Denise, thanks very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you very much.
In a bit, a Palestinian artist gets personal, real personal, with her subjects. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You usually find Tuvan throat singers near Mongolia, but sometimes they're hanging out in Vienna, Austria.
Right now, I'm sitting at the hairstyling salon, African hairstyling salon. As you see, I'm having always Kondro.
Sanko Namchalak, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If you're not in New England or from here, it might surprise you that Maine is home to many refugees from Somalia. They began resettling there not long after 9/11. Fitting in has not always been easy for Somalis in a state that's 95% white. But there's also tension within the Somali community in Maine, between those who arrived first and those who came later. My WGBH colleague Philip Martin reports on how these tensions affect young Somalis in Lewiston, the second largest city in Maine.
You can feel the tension in Lewiston. The working class city has faced closed textile mills, factories moving overseas, and new immigrants. Some in traditional Muslim dress bumping up against whites born here.
You know, folks are struggling in this community, and they're looking for someone to blame.
Genevieve Lyson is a community organizer. Part of her work is with African refugees, some who now run businesses that have revitalized the city's downtown. Paul LePage, Maine's Tea Party-backed governor, has publicly suggested that federal assistance gives Somalis an unfair advantage. Lewiston's mayor, Robert McDonald, also said government support for refugees must end and that Somalis weren't doing enough to integrate themselves here. Addressing Somalis on TV, he said,
if you want to come in here and you want to celebrate your holidays, I don't care. I don't care. Just don't try to insert your culture, which obviously isn't working, into ours, which does.
Fighting racism here unites Somalis, but cultural and historical differences linked to their home country divides them too. Mujahideen Laba is a leader of Lewiston's Bantu Somalis. They're descendants of 19th century slaves in Somalia and are physically and culturally distinct from what he calls regular or ethnic Somalis. Bantu Somalis started arriving to Lewiston about 6 years after the first wave of ethnic Somalis. Laba says his countrymen weren't so welcoming.
If there are three Somalis sitting in a bar or in a cafe, and a Somali Bantu person shows up, they will all stand up and leave. So now we started having our own cafe, we started having our own shops, so we're doing our own thing.
Into all this, Fatima Ali arrived with her family to Lewiston at age 9. She's Bantu Somali and 19 years old now. Looking back, she says, she knew she was seen a certain way by some Somalis.
When people think of me as like Bantu, they look at me and they're just like, she's probably not going to go anywhere.
But she did. Ali is now a freshman nursing student at the University of Southern Maine. She's the first in the family to go to college, and she joins a growing number of young Bantu Somalis in Lewiston, defying the poverty and prejudice that have followed them from Africa to America.
It makes me, like, very responsible. Like, I have to be the responsible one, the one that brings things to the family. Basically, I'm holding a very, like, powerful seat in the house right now.
And Ali credits an after-school initiative here for her success. It's called the Tree Street Youth Program. Julia Sleeper runs the center.
Finding success in school is the number one top priority for absolutely any of our families, but in particular, any of our immigrant or refugee families.
Starting her freshman year, Ali came here after school every day to continue learning.
I didn't really know anything at all. I didn't even know how to do my homework. They helped me and everything.
Tree Street is where Ali says she caught the bug to become a nurse.
They told me that there was like a class there for me, like a pre-nursing course there for me, and I signed up and I got in there and I got my nursing certificate. It's been pretty a good ride.
But Tree Street doesn't just focus on academics. It also prioritizes putting kids of different backgrounds in the same room. Julia Sleeper says ethnic Somalis and Bantu Somali kids are encouraged to get along, and many, like Ali, do.
I mean, half of my friends are Somalian, so I really don't have any problems with them at all.
But getting to this point for young Bantu Somalis takes work, says Sleeper.
It's all part of them fleshing out, like, who am I now? And we want them to know their old culture because they can't make that connection of why that culture is even valuable here.
Mujahideen Laba, the Bantu Somali leader, worries about all this, about young Bantu who feel isolated from other Somalis ditching their heritage and gravitating instead toward African-American culture, including hip-hop.
The pants are falling off. They have these funny hats. They have different kinds of jackets. You know, all kinds of hip-hop cultures, I mean.
Fatuma Ali gets this. But Ali, who wears a colorful hijab, says she reassures her parents that liking hip-hop doesn't mean she's any less Muslim or Bantu.
They don't really mind. Like, they trust me.
At the Tree Street program, the doors have just opened for the day. A shy Bantu boy is already waiting outside. Volunteers are here too, including Fatuma Ali, now helping other young Bantu navigate their identity in a new but divided city. For the World, Philip Martin, Lewiston, Maine.
Now, you may have seen the hashtag traditionally submissive trending on Twitter this week. It's a response to an alleged comment made by British Prime Minister David Cameron. He announced funding this week for a program offering free English lessons for migrants in the UK. Publicly, Cameron said that would specifically help Muslim women. But according to some reports, he privately added that Muslim women normally don't speak up against extremism because of their traditional submissiveness. Well, hundreds of Muslim women turned to Twitter to prove that stereotype wrong. Zainab Mirza was one of the first people to use the hashtag traditionally submissive. She works for a nonprofit in central London, and she says there's been a range of responses on Twitter.
I personally prefer the ones from our slightly older generation because I think it completely smashes the stereotypes apart. I know David Cameron's comments were probably referring to kind of second, third generation or women who I perhaps kind of assume are young mothers right now. However, the elder generation have absolutely smashed apart the stereotypes, being on Twitter, being across social media. And for me, those are my personal favorites. But there's one thing that my colleagues were even mentioning, because they've been following the trend at work, is that they were so shocked, not shocked, but actually in awe of how many languages the elder generation speak. So not only have they studied, not only are they mothers, grandmothers, but they have also mentioned 2-3 languages that they can actually speak.
Yeah, so we learned that not only do Muslim women, a lot of them speak English, but a lot of them speak many other languages as well. If you turn to the younger generation's tweets, there's a great one of a woman in a headscarf holding a sign that says, "Black belt in karate, aspiring scientist." I'm wondering if this has ever been personal for you. I mean, have you ever felt like the submissive Muslim woman stereotype has been applied to you? And what was that like? What did you do about it?
Unfortunately, I have. I mean, I wish it wasn't the case. And I'm sure if you asked many Muslim women, they would say the same thing. But I mean, growing up, I've had that a lot. When I tell people that not only did I stay in student accommodation at university, but in fact, my father is the one who pushed us to do so. And I've always seen that people are very surprised by that, because they, again, not only assume that a Muslim woman wouldn't be able to do that, but they assume that her father would be putting barriers in her way when it comes to education.
That's a great anecdote, and I'm glad you told it on radio, because it's a lot longer than 140 characters. So why turn to Twitter?
Because most of us were actually quite insulted and offended by what David Cameron said. And, you know, there's ways of kind of approaching it in terms of, like, you know, petitions and sending letters to MPs and all those different democratic processes. But social media is so powerful these days. Personally, I didn't realize it would be so successful in what we actually wanted to achieve. But I think Twitter was the perfect place to do that in terms of getting attention from people and everyone joining in. And what's been fantastic about it was actually that it went beyond Muslim women. It went to men being supportive, to non-Muslim people getting involved. We've had responses from people in India and, like yourselves, in America. And it's just reached people, like, it's reached press so quickly. I don't think, personally, I didn't estimate that. And I'm really glad that it's done that. And I would absolutely love a response from David Cameron. But, you know, we're still waiting for that.
Precisely. I mean, David Cameron has not admitted to making these comments. They were reported out of a private conversation. What would you want to hear from him?
I'd like to hear what he truly thinks a Muslim woman is, to be honest, because I feel that often he projects the wrong image of Muslim women. And actually, my colleague said something earlier which really made me think. She said, it's not actually about him suggesting English lessons, is the way in which he does it. You know, English, it's great if you suggest that you want people to be more successful in what they do, you want to increase their chances of employability, which is a big issue, you know, in London and across the UK here, particularly with ethnic minorities, then that would be perceived very differently to suggesting, whether he said traditionally submissive or not, the fact in itself that he's focusing this funding on Muslim women, saying that they, suggesting that they can't actually speak English, or that a lot of them can't speak English, or that they're actually somehow naive to what's going on with their children, just kind of creates the completely wrong image of what a Muslim woman was. So it is. So I would like to actually hear from him what he really thinks.
Zainab Mirza, who teaches financial literacy, was one of the first to use the hashtag traditionally submissive in response to a reported comment by British leader David Cameron. Zainab, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay, let me take you now to an African hair salon in Vienna, Austria, where we track down a throat singer from Tuva, north of Mongolia. I know, a bunch of seemingly unrelated nouns there. Throat singing, African hair salon, Vienna, Mongolia. It makes sense, though, when the singer in question is Senko Namchilak.
Right now, I am sitting at the hairstyling salon, African hairstyling salon. As you see, I'm having always cornrow.
Oh, really?
African extension, yeah.
Senko Namchilak is one of a kind. In her speaking voice there, you can even hear that buzz, that resonance that allows her body to make the sounds we in the West generically call throat singing.
Yeah.
Raw and unfiltered, that's the voice of Sanko Namchalak. She can go from that buzz to volumes more adapted to primal scream therapy. And most recently, this is how she's adapted her style of throat singing. Your music has evolved so much. If you were to do throat singing back in Tuva, would Tuvans recognize it as their music?
Maybe they will recognize it and say, oh yes, it's kind of modern interpretation of our traditional singing. I am not singing clearly traditional music. I am using it in a mixture of Asian scales and some kind of traditional Afro-American blues and soul scales, you know, for this kind of type music.
I mean, we really hear that in this song. I heard it and I thought you sounded like Billie Holiday. Did anybody else notice that?
No. I have my goddess singers I love and I like to listen. From my childhood, the first I discovered was Ima Sumac, and then I discovered, of course, Ella Fitzgerald and Miriam Makeba, and then Billie Holiday, and then later on, of course, Tina Turner, singers like this, you know, or Amy Winehouse. So they are all my favorite singers. I would like to listen always.
Sanko's latest album is out this week. It's called Like a Bird or Spirit, Not a Face. For it, she teamed up with a Tuareg rock band from Mali, Tenariwen. The Tuva-Timbuktu connection produced striking results. Sanko says the most memorable thing for her was hearing Tenariwen's insistently soft rhythms and voices.
When they start to play and sing very soft, you know, very, very soft voice and singing, it's like, yeah, it's very interesting effect. It's like they start to look inside your memory, inside of memory of each person or people around, or human beings, you know. They're like, how to say, they're inside of listeners, you know.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting counterpoint to you because you are all about the power of the voice.
Yeah, but I was thinking very much about it, and I just discovered that I'm just on outside like this. You know, I'm just a loud one.
And on
you
the
know,
inside?
Loud, open, la-la-la-la, very kind of expressive singer. But it doesn't mean I'm having power, you know, yet, you know. They show something very silent, very soft, but so strong, you know. I just got really a message with this.
My conversation with Sanko as she waited for her appointment in the African Salon in Vienna was soon to come to an end. She was about to be called to take a chair and have her cornrows done, but first she wanted to sing.
Okay, that's it.
Wow, that was fantastic. You're in a salon in Vienna. What did the what did the hairdressers think when they saw you singing?
I don't know. What do you think? Do you like it? You heard I'm singing, no? Yeah. Yeah, she likes it.
Excellent. All right.
You see how she's answering? Very tender.
Yeah,
so,
very tender.
You know?
Well,
yeah.
Have a great appointment. Sanko Namchalak.
Thank you very much.
Those cornrows ended up looking pretty good. Sanko sent us a selfie. You can check it out at pri.org. Coming up, are Europe's open borders about to be closed? This is The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Let's go back to where we began today with the migrant crisis in Europe. More than 1 million migrants have streamed into the continent in the past year, and some countries have responded by reinstating border controls. That's a huge deal because it throws Europe's open borders policy into chaos. That policy is based on the Schengen Agreement, a pact that did away with the need for passports to cross the common borders of 26 European nations. Americans can't even do that with Canada. Constance Stelzenmüller is a senior fellow at Brookings. She says Schengen was meant to reshape Europe when it came into force in 1995.
Essentially supposed to make the European Union borderless so that people, goods, trade, travel, but also political relations could take place between these countries without the additional burden of having to show your passport and go through customs. So if there is, you know, one symbol of European unity that really has trickled down to people's normal lives beyond the euro, the common currency, it really is the Schengen Agreement.
And I imagine pretty liberating for a lot of Europeans who could potentially drive from the North Cape of Norway all the way down to the Spanish town of Tarifa, which is practically in Morocco and Africa. Is it all starting to unravel now with the refugee influx?
I think personally, and I hope I'm not proven wrong, that this agreement and the ideas it embodies is so important to all of us that nobody in their right mind, except maybe some of the really right-wing fringe in Europe, would advocate abolishing it altogether. And I'm inclined to think that even the really right wing, which do exist, would know better than to do that because European businesses would be in an uproar. You know, the trucks moving goods back and forth, for them to have to wait in front of a border in mile-long lines again, or as we would say, kilometer-long lines, that would not make anybody very popular.
If Schengen is the kind of physical manifestation of European unity, how much is European unity, how much is the EU under pressure right now?
Well, some of this may be payback for German perceived high-handedness, arrogance in the treatment of Greece, of the Eurozone crisis, and certainly of a retaliation for the fact that when the Germans opened the border last summer, that placed an enormous burden on the countries of transit between Turkey and Greece and Germany. But I have to say that I was very impressed by Angela Merkel making this decision, and I still think that she was both morally and in the long term politically right to do this. But we also have to acknowledge that this was not well handled in terms of negotiating the impact on Germany's neighbors. So yes, there may be some punishment involved, and I think that doesn't change the fact that what is needed now is some kind of European compromise, a European conversation about how to mitigate this, because the problem is not going to go away if you simply close the borders. And as we have learned, and indeed as America has learned at its Mexican borders, it is impossible to completely close off a border. People find a way if they're desperate enough. In other words, this is not a problem that you can just solve by putting up border controls again.
Constance Stelzenmüller there, a senior fellow at Brookings. Finally, on the show, yesterday we talked about one aspect of culture in the Israeli-Palestinian standoff in the West Bank, pop tunes that glorify violence. Now let's hear about a young artist there who creates in a very different way. Daniel Estrin has a story from Ramallah.
It's opening night for the latest exhibition at Zawiya Gallery. There's wine and pastries, and it's quite a turnout. Palestinian politician Hanan Ashrawi is here. So is a prominent Palestinian businessman and his wife, contemporary art collectors. Established local artists are exhibiting their work along with some up-and-coming artists. Gallery owner Ziad Amami is particularly excited about one of them, 30-year-old Rana Samara.
Rana's work, I mean, is excellent, and you can tell she's a very young talent, and there should be a bright future ahead of her.
Rana's a recent graduate of the International Academy of Art in Ramallah. Ziad, the gallery owner, saw two of her paintings at a small exhibition of art school graduates, and he bought them both.
We have a lot of artists that work on the Palestinian struggle, and they use politics, they show the occupation, they show the struggle with Palestinian, how we're living. But Rana's works are different.
So what are we looking at in this painting?
What do you think?
It's a bedroom. I see a bed that's empty, and there's a tie, and there's a plate with an orange peel, and maybe hanging from the bed, maybe underwear?
Yes, it's underwear.
Her paintings are enormous bright murals of empty bedrooms post-sex. It's a subject she started looking into as a second-year art student after she visited a friend living in a West Bank refugee camp.
When I go there, I stopped in the front of the camp and I started questioning, like, how did people make sex? How did they sleep together?
There's very little privacy in West Bank refugee camps. We're talking crowded concrete shanty towns. Palestinians ended up in them after they were uprooted from their homes in the 1948 war that led to Israel's founding.
Then I start to meet women in the camp and just ask them the question, how did you sleep with your husband? It's a horrible space because the building next to each other, one woman told me that her husband put his hand in her mouth to keep the voice down.
She painted some of the bedrooms of the women she interviewed. One painting shows a pack of Viagra in the corner. On another one, she painted the patterns from a woman's lingerie. She says some Palestinian colleagues tell her she should be painting about more crucial things, like Israeli military occupation.
Many artists, like, give you a critique, like, you, a woman, why you want to talk about sex, we are a Palestinian. The sex, it's the last thing we should talk about. Why it's not an issue? Yeah, it's an issue. We can't talk about it. But I think I talk about it in, like, a polite way, not in, like, a very rude way.
She paints in the style of Matisse or David Hockney, big, colorful still-life portraits. She's breaking taboos as a female artist dealing with such intimate subject matter, though people I spoke to at the exhibit said they weren't bothered by her paintings. Another artist exhibiting here is Juhayna Habibi Kandalaft, born 1 year before Palestinians were expelled or fled in 1948. Her paintings are about Palestinian pride and heritage. They depict women wearing traditional embroidered dress. I asked her what she thought of Rana Samara's unconventional take.
It is not necessary always to talk about Palestinian core issues.
It's life here.
Palestinians have to talk about life as well.
This is Rana Samara's first professional art exhibition. She's been accepted to a Master's of Fine Arts program at the California Institute of the Arts, and she's trying to raise some funds so she can afford it. Her dream is to exhibit her work at the Venice Biennale as the official Palestinian representative. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Ramallah.
You can see Rana Samara's bedroom paintings at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.